Hey folks, it's Christian, welcoming you to another edition of the Ice Age Farmer Podcast. Mapping a path forward to prosperity. Building self-sufficient, resilient communities. And sharing knowledge in the grand solar minimum. It is Thursday, October 26th, and this is episode 19 of the podcast. We got a lot of ground to cover today. We'll be starting with grand solar minimum related news, and actually a little broader scope today, but there's a lot of that to cover. We'll also be sharing some steps from folks in the Ice Age farmer community, the steps that people are taking every day to bring themselves and their families closer to self-sufficiency and food security. I'll be sharing a note from a farmer in Indiana and some others on the symptoms that he is noticing changes over the last few years and the way that things are going on his farm, what he's been noticing and how things are going there. I'll be answering a question from a viewer. How much light, how many lux, he asks, does it take to grow spirulina? The best answer is it's a function, it's a fuzzy function. I'll share a graph to look at that. Then I'll be getting into the item of the day, which is a fat USB battery that I take basically everywhere with me. And then I'll be covering a crop focus on brassicas, which I've promised before but neglected to actually ever get to. So we'll do that today. Before we do all that, though, I would like to remind you that I have arranged for Ice Age Farmer listeners to get 10% off everything at theaquaponicsource.com. Whether you're building an aquaponic or hydroponic system, or you're just picking up some fish food, that is an interesting store, so take a look at that and see if there's something you could use there. Also, for algae farmers, those of you trying your hand at spirulina, can get 10% off at the algaeresearchsupply.com store. To get these discounts, send me a note, iceagefarmer@gmail.com. Let me know what you're working on, what steps you are taking to improve your food security, and I'll share that information with you. Alternatively, you can support Ice Age Farmer via patreon.com/iceagefarmer and get all those discounts. And thank you all for your support. I genuinely appreciate it. And with that, let's get right into the grand solar minimum related news. First, this from the National Weather Service. They are to begin issuing a new type of snow warning called a snow squall, which indicates short-term bursts of unusually heavy snow. This and all links that I'll mention are below. The National Weather Service indicates in its product description, which is an important thing to remember when you're thinking about the National Weather Service, that this is a product to them, that the annual highway fatalities from these snow squall class events can exceed the fatalities due to tornadoes in many years, and that's why they claim they're introducing this new snow squall warning. Adding to the headlines from last episode and from the special alert that I issued about the decline in the insect population, actually the complete collapse, like up to 75-80% of the insect flying insect population has been decimated. Check out that video if you've not, because it is alarming. And I'm not just saying that. From the day after I put that alert out, this came out of the British Beekeepers Association and was covered by the BBC. Concern for the future of bees after the decline in the honey crop. Reading from the article, the British Beekeepers Association says the average yield per hive in England and Wales was down by a full kilogram this year. That's 2.3 pounds per hive less honey yield from the previous years, and that the numbers have been dropping for decades. Wales and southwest England were two of the lowest producers of honey. Both regions suffered particularly wet summers. While weather can cause fluctuations in honey yield, however, the British Beekeepers Association says it is continuing overall decline in the quality that is most worrying. So add that to the list of reasons to be concerned about the pollinators. Moving on, and this isn't directly related to the grand solar minimum, but it is something that I just think everyone needs to know. Certainly all parents would be interested, and it does, after all, speak to being more self-sufficient, to growing your own food so that you know what's in it, and preparing your own baby food, which is pretty easy given fresh vegetables. You just heat them up and smush them up. The Clean Label Project, and I'm picking this up out of local news from Pittsburgh, because I certainly didn't see it in any national news, that the Clean Label Project released a 5-month study result indicating that over 500 products tested in stores for baby food, of them, over 65% containing arsenic, a third of them containing lead, and over half of them with cadmium in them. Needless to say, any amount of the three of these elements is not ideal for the growth of your child, or for any human being's longevity, for that matter. And this is upsetting. So suffice to say, as I've already indicated, grow your own food and you'll know what's in it. Don't buy. You can't depend on corporations or the state, for that matter, to give you food that is not poisoned, much less actually nutritive. You should be doing this yourself. That just pisses me off. Enough said. This, China grows rice in salt water to feed 200 million people. Very cool that they have actually succeeded at growing a crop in salt water. I have seen some studies and sort of preliminary results at using duckweed to desalinate water, to actually like pull minerals and stuff out of it to make it drinkable. But this is actually awesome, to actually produce rice from salinated water. Let's move on. From over on notrickszone.com, the advanced weather forecasting models confirm urban heat island effect. It's very real. This a confirmation that the effect of cities on the temperatures is actually non-negligible, which means that the majority of temperature readings, which are done at stations within city limits, are biased towards the hot end. This at least having some part in corrupting the temperature data set, not speaking of the actual deliberate fudging of data sets and data raking that goes on. And we've seen that actually exposed at the bomb in Australia and at multiple official locations, not to even mention ClimateGate. I mean, let's not even get into this nonsense of the climate cult, but I thought this was an interesting, actually documenting deterministically this effect. Well done. Turning our focus back to Puerto Rico briefly, we've already covered in previous episodes that 100% of their agriculture was wiped out. That's done. And I just want to continue to nail home the point that their power is still out for roughly 75% of that island. And that even as of, you know, their official goal right now, by December 15th, another month and a half away, to get 95% of the way done. So they're not going to be done bringing that grid up even by the end of this year. Just bear that in mind when we live our lives that depend on that grid staying up. This is a precarious arrangement at best. All right, looking at the hailstorms, GSM hail, hashtag. There are two notable ones that I wanted to mention today. The first in Formosa, Argentina, where, look at the size of that sucker, where a massive hailstorm did a ton of damage both to people and places and, of course, to crops, which is going to be a real problem. In Argentina right now, it is spring, and so they have seedlings and new plants coming up, and this obviously did a number on them. They were completely destroyed, including the newly germinated soybeans, as were thousands of buildings, cars, trees, and boats on the Paraguay River, reported up to 8 centimeters in diameter there. Not to be outdone, in Nimbuku, Paraguay, a severe hailstorm was captured here and reported on a Facebook page, Severe World Weather. Looking brutal there for a spring day. And I feel really bad for that cow. Moving on to the GSM rain hashtag, indicating torrential rain often causing flash flooding and or mudslides, and of course, crop losses. Today, we'll look at Bulgaria, where torrential rain yesterday was indeed fatal for some folks, and 3 of the dead drowned when their houses were suddenly inundated by flood water. An elderly man in the village of Polski Izvor was on the ground floor of his house when a 1.5 meter wave of water hit it. The wave of water was part of a heavy torrent that began at about 4 a.m. In less than an hour, more than 60 liters a square meter of water fell. And that illustrates pretty effectively the GSM rain hashtag in a nutshell, the landslides, the flash flooding, the crop losses that result from these torrential dumps of water from above. Here now as well, I'm showing footage via Yamkin's Earth Changing Extremities blog from Boone and flash floods in North Carolina at the Watauga River flooding and the rainfall across the Carolinas, which will transition us right into the GSM storm tag. Had plenty of stuff to cover. The storm in the Carolinas left nearly 100,000 people without power. As well, there was the storm that struck Hawaii, which took out the entire island of Maui's grid, leaving 150,000 people without power there. They got nailed. And of course, this is on the tail of Brian striking Ireland and the UK, which mercifully turned out to be less severe than people had been anticipating, some people. And of course, Typhoon Lan, which struck fatally, so Japan, doing an estimated $61 million in damage between farming and fishing industries. And of course, this is the new normal. There are, right now, more storms on the way, which are predicted to strike the Caribbean and the U.S. East Coast, including Florida. Moving right on to the GSM sick hashtag, indicating that there are increased disease outbreaks, epidemics during grand solar minima, usually related to people's depressed immune systems. The WHO, World Health Organization, has just finished issuing warnings to 9 countries that do business or have travelers commonly traveling between their country and Madagascar, which of course is in the midst of the largest pneumonic plague outbreak in recent history. Remember to break out your thieves' oil if you're traveling to one of those 9 or 10 countries now. The GSM food hashtag covering crop losses, food prices. We have spoken to crop losses mentioned elsewhere already, but I wanted to throw in that the world wine production, due to the extreme weather in the top 3 producing countries, has reached a 50-year low. And also, the corn and soybeans, as we've been covering here on this podcast for basically the entire time, are way behind expectations. This has driven a market response. Finally, the GSM ELEC tag, indicating increased electrical activity in Earth's atmosphere. Check it out. We have a whole flock, 35 sheep, that were struck dead by lightning. This reminiscent of the 300, whatever it was, reindeer that all died in a large lightning strike there as well. Explicitly called out to be positive lightning here in Arkansas. Look at these anvil crawler bolts. Beautifully captured here. And then down below, we'll see that this positive lightning actually struck the ground and left a large hole here. I mean, this is ridiculous. So this is a highly charged atmosphere, electrical events that are, I mean, it's not unprecedented, but they are happening at an extremely increased frequency, as are, in general, lightning fatalities, and that data is available. You can confirm that, and please do. And finally, here in Oklahoma, red sprites again captured. They call them rare, but we are seeing them more and more, as I'm saying, because of the increased charge in our atmosphere and the loss of our magnetosphere. But they are quite beautiful, as we'll see here. It's also worth keeping an eye on the Canary Islands. The Spanish government is flying in quote-unquote experts because they fear an eruption there any minute. And with that, let's go ahead and move into the daily steps that folks in the Ice Age farmer community are taking to ensure their food security and their families' ability to thrive as the climate changes and modern agriculture fumbles and we're left to fend for ourselves and build resilient communities. First, from Zionte Girl. Good morning, Christian. I just ordered organic hawthorn, berries, leaf, and flowers, and wide mouth gallon jars to make a large batch of hawthorn tincture to support the heart, i.e. for hypertension. I have been making this and other tinctures for almost 18 years. It has been a very effective way to manage hypertension. There will be other tinctures to follow. It is part of my medicine chest as we move forward into the grand solar minimum. I haven't found yet a way to manage hypothyroidism yet, but we'll keep looking. For those who have type 2 diabetes, Dr. Jason Fung out of Canada has been successfully treating type 2 diabetes with fasting. Fasting also does great things for the brain. There are many YouTube videos where Dr. Fung addresses fasting, health, and diabetes. I appreciate your videos very much. Zionte Girl, I appreciate your daily steps very much. Thanks for reaching out. I'll have to check into Dr. Jason Fung. And everyone knows we don't issue medical advice on this podcast, but these are the steps that we're taking to ensure that should the medical system cease to exist as we know it, that we have been actively working towards our own solutions and taking our, you know, ultimately it is we who are responsible for our health at the end of any day. And so these are the steps that folks are taking to try and promote that health, our very health. Next, from Laverne. Some people say I'm crazy, while others have heard of global cooling, but don't want to talk about it, as they say they will take their chances. I have been trying to get prepared and have been sharing information. My daughter is finally starting to listen and ponder self-sufficiency for the future. Perhaps if she gets on board, some of our other family members and friends will also take some kind of initiative to ponder and prepare. Hopefully prepare, not just ponder. And yes, hopefully the rest of your family and friends will hop on board. From Deborah Compton. Dear Ice Age Farmer, I love your news reports. I have a few acres in a very small Wisconsin town where I am working on my preparedness by storing and growing food and by raising extreme cold hardy chickens. I have been working on selective breeding my chickens to be triple purpose. Decent egg production, meat production, and broodiness, all while free ranging and predator savvy. These chickens survived the extreme cold of negative 20 with a wind chill of minus 40. I'm sure that's Fahrenheit. We had a few years ago during which I selected to be my breeding stock. My birds have no coop and no supplemental heat. I raise live bugs for them to eat through the winter to supplement their diet. I will continue perfecting my breed, which she calls the Compton, as my local weather continues to deteriorate over the next few years. My goal is to have a self-sustaining population of very large birds that survive on minimal resources in extreme cold. Wish me luck. Deborah, that's awesome to see that you're selectively breeding your chickens now for the conditions that you anticipate are soon going to be meeting us. I think this is some great thinking, and I'm thrilled to share it. Thank you for sharing it with me so we could talk about it here. What steps are you taking today to ensure your ability to thrive, no matter what happens to our electrical grid, no matter what yield comes out of our modern corporate agricultural systems, or what crop losses afflict it? How do you feel about your ability to be resilient in any number of different looking tomorrows? And I'm not just, this isn't rhetoric. I'm not just asking this to sound funny or cool or, you know, this is, I'm literally, I'm looking you in the eye as best I can through this medium, and I'm asking you, what are you doing to make sure that you're going to be cool tomorrow? Let me know. I'm eager to hear it, and everyone wants to build up this community and share that out. So on my front, I am, damn, dude, I had some deer come through and decimate 5 of my fruit trees. They were only about a year or two old. They are some of the avocados that I had started, as well as some apricot trees and a cherry tree that was, I think it'll survive, but man, it took a beating. Needless to say, the deer also did everything they could to harvest my squash for me and decimate the rest of my plants. Seems like they like really thick-leafed plants, my wife observed. So I see now why people invest even good amounts of money in an effective deer fence, because that's pretty frustrating. On the crickets front, which is inside, the other, you know, everything else I'll have to report on is inside, away from those deer. The crickets, I have now about 300 subadults and another 300 pinheads that are still hatching. Hopefully there's a lot more in there, which is now more than the 500 crickets with which I started. But they're not yet to laying age, so I'm still in a weird time right now where there's a new baby population, but I don't have any adults at the moment. But I will keep this going and hope to report some success there. On the moringa front, I have these trees continuing to produce leaves, even though it's getting cold. And, you know, it's late October. It's almost November now. Of course, I'm in Northern California, but they're still producing new shoots and new leaves. And that's great. I didn't know if they, because they're such a tropical plant, if they would, in an indoor, artificially lit environment, even be producing this late in the year. But they are. That said, I have not yet been able at any time to get the dwarf varieties that I have to grow to seed, which was the point. So I need to look into that, maybe research other ways to get moringas to grow to seed, because I'll need, you know, that's to close the loop on that pipeline. You need some of whatever crop you're growing to seed so that you can keep planting them, as we know. And then I have been doing a lot of research building on the some of the biodynamic philosophies that we've talked about in previous episodes. I've been burning through reading Mel Bartholomew's Square Foot Gardening, John Jeevan's Biointensive Agriculture, some of his books, and now Brett Markham's Mini Farming, Self-Sufficiency on a Quarter Acre. Double digging, which the latter of those two do, seems like a lot of work compared to some of the no-till approaches, lasagna gardening, Ruth Stout's approach. But so I'm inclined to like the idea of doing less work. But that's why I am surveying the research, looking at what other people have done in their, you know, decades of gardening in various conditions. And we are truly privileged in that we're able to stand on the shoulders of giants who have been doing this their entire lives, and even generations of folks doing it their entire lives. But that still leaves the question, on whose shoulders should I stand? There are different approaches. And I think this is a personal question. Different people with different physical abilities, and certainly in different locations, are going to have different levels of success with different approaches. What has worked for you? I'd love to know. Let me know in the comments below, or shoot me a note, iceagefarmer@gmail.com. Before I get into our next segment, I'd like to remind you briefly that there is a wiki set up for show notes from all of the episodes of the Ice Age Farmer podcast, as well as basically anything we touch on, anything we talk about, or anything we think about within the Ice Age Farmer community gets written up there. It is fun to browse and look at and read from. It's definitely something that would be nice to have an offline copy of. And it's something that's fun to add to. So what have you done in your past that would be interesting or relevant for our pursuits now? Please go ahead and sign up and add your knowledge there, or shoot me a note and I can add it for you if you're not comfortable adding wiki stuff. I'd love to have your expertise there. That wiki is available at wiki.iceagefarmer.com. Next up, I'd like to share with you a note that I received from a farmer in Indiana. His name is Richard. He writes, "Hello, My name is Richard. I am a small produce farmer in Indiana. I've been seeing a lot of tech answers to the grand solar minimum, but what about some old solutions? We grow a small patch of American Indian corn for hominy, which can be eaten boiled or ground into a flour. Mixed with black beans, it makes a very hearty chili. Flint corns are lower yielding but very hardy and have shorter days to maturity than other types. We have found flower corns will mold or sprout on the plant during wet falls, which we anticipate we'll see more of. We usually transplant the corn in the spring, the cover with 6 inches of straw. We like to then plant long pie pumpkins between the corn in early June. Long pie pumpkins, which I'll throw up a picture here, are the hardiest and longest storing pumpkins we've found and grown. Even completely neglected, they will produce something. They are shaped like large zucchini and can be stacked to store just like firewood. Just wanted to share some thoughts from a small-time vegetable farmer with a background in archaeology. Because of the big ag GMO corn production around us, we've been forced to grow our corn during bean years. It has allowed us to plan for a harvest in 1 out of 3 years. The dried hominy can be made into flour or boiled and used in soups or eaten plain. We have had so many weather extremes this growing season, but most people see nothing out of the ordinary around us. Richard wrote again after I issued the alert about the collapsing insect population and mentioned that in episode 18 as well. He wrote, once again, I wanted to pass on our insect observations. This year, we have seen at least a 400% increase in beetles. They seem to be targeting non-traditional crops, however. Cucumber beetles attacking green beans, lettuce, spring mix. We began seeing flea beetles as early as February. Beetles of every type remain active as I write this, beneficial and non. And this is in October 24th. All of our beehives have collapsed. We have one wild colony in a hive box. This is despite plentiful pollinator strips and a full lawn of white clover. Briefly, Joe Ron commented on insects. Here in Indiana this summer was almost devoid of any insects. Very few bees or flies all summer. And frogs, where are the frogs? They were few and far between this year. Spiders are another thing that doesn't live long this year, with no food. Thank you both, Joe and absolutely Richard, for writing in with your ideas and observations there. I very much appreciate that. Finally, I wanted to share a note from a farmer in Oregon who just was observing that normally fall sort of gradually sneaks up on us, but not this year. One day it was 95, and a few days later, frost was on the roof. That from Oregon. All right, next I wanted to address a question from a viewer. The question was asked, how many lux are needed to grow spirulina? For those of you who don't know, lux is a measurement of light. And I think, ultimately, lately I've been looking at lux per watt as one of the bottom line indicators of how effective and efficient a light source is. The best answer that is specific to the spirulina question here, and I'll pull up a graph for those of you watching the video, is that here it is. Here is the doubling rate of the spirulina as a function of how many lux the culture is receiving. And so you can see It begins around 500 lux is the minimum to even register on this graph. And then there is a sweet spot right around 2000 lux. But really anywhere between 1500 to 2500 would be in this sweet spot. I think the more relevant one, let me pull up also the temperature chart. Here we can see that this has also a large effect on how what's called the doubling rate of your spirulina culture, and that the optimum is right in between 89 to 98 degrees Fahrenheit. That's where you want to keep your culture, anywhere in that range. And it's not like you're going to get nothing outside of that. As you can tell, above that, it drops off pretty quickly. And in fact, you'll start killing it if you get over 108, 109. But below that, there is still some wiggle room where you will be growing a culture, just not nearly doubling as quickly as you could be. And so I hope this answer helps you. If you want to check out the crop focus documents on spirulina, I have links from the Ice Age Farmer Wiki to these studies, and they are all available there for you. So I hope this helps. And with that, I wanted to mention the item of the day, which is a battery that I picked up, gosh, a year or two ago, and literally just use it so much that I wanted to throw it out here. The item of the day is something that I use on a daily or near daily basis, and so it turns out to be just worthwhile, and that's why I mention these things. Today, it's a USB battery, which is small and light enough for the everyday carry bag, and I carry it everywhere I go. But it packs enough power to charge your phone over a few times over. In fact, I've never had these discharge all the way because it's just got 20,000 milliamp hours and it hasn't happened yet. I'm sure it'd be easy enough to do. I carry this as well as a little collapsible solar panel to charge it up if I do start using it. But it's right now marked down from $80 to half price, $40. And so I thought I would throw this one out there, the Anker 20,000 milliamp hour USB battery. Put it in your everyday carry bag, keep it topped off, and you know, your phone is probably your number one go-to item. That's why you carry it everywhere you go for the initial stage of the emergency, finding out more information. So you want to keep this guy charged at all times, and really there's just no excuse to be anywhere and have your phone die on you. It's ridiculous. At least carry a small lipstick battery or something. And then you can consider yourself at least that much more prepared. Like I said, daily steps every day. Let this be a step. If you're doing nothing else today, put a battery in your everyday carry bag. Make sure it's charged and you can keep going. Okay, let's finish up today with a crop focus on brassicas. We had started doing crop focus a while ago to sort of zoom in on a particular thing after we did the general plant biology and how plant nutrients work and the water cycle and the nitrogen cycle. Now we're digging into some specific varieties, specific crops. Today, Brassica oleracea, which is a subset of brassicas that actually has a ton of different recognizable morphological phenotypes. So as you can see here already, we have cauliflower and broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and then these are all, kohlrabi is another not pictured, all of these are actually Brassica oleracea. They're all the same species. They're just different breeds, like dogs, right? Different specialties that have been bred from within this same species. So what does that mean? What that does mean, if you're going to be growing these things to seed, then you can sort of only pick one of these specific breeds within the species, or else they'll crossbreed, right? So they're all the same species, so they will definitely cross with each other. So if you want to keep your cauliflower white, you can only breed that one per season, or you'll need to employ some of the techniques that we've referenced but not really spoken at length to, like bagging the heads of the flowers, and you know, there are techniques that you can use to keep all of your varieties alive each year, but in terms of simply growing things in proximity, that's sort of like you get one. At any rate, let me read now from seed to seed. Brassica oleracea, specifically in this case, broccoli and cauliflower. Broccoli and cauliflower varieties are available in purple, green, and white. Prior to the turn of the century, purple broccoli was more common than green broccoli. Interesting. Broccoli was described in garden literature long before cauliflower. In Italy, the name broccoli originally referred to the tender shoots produced by various kinds of overwintered cabbage. The shoots were highly regarded and were grown in the royal gardens. Broccoli ceased to be a cabbage as gardeners selected and cultivated plants that produced the tenderest shoots in the greatest abundance. Centuries of this selection resulted in varieties similar to the sprouting broccoli of today. As this selection continued, some plants exhibited white curds and were slowly themselves developed into what is now known as cauliflower. And so that's the story, the genesis of these different breeds within the same species. Broccoli, as we've been talking about, but continuing to read from seed to seed, broccoli and cauliflower belong to the genus Brassica and the species Oleracea. Brassica oleracea is a very large species whose different vegetable members can be grouped into 8 subspecies according to physical characteristics. Broccoli and cauliflower are members of the Brotritis group. Always remember that these groups will cross readily with one another because they are all Brassica oleracea. Alright, sorry, I sort of mentioned a lot of that already. Broccoli and cauliflower are outbreeding plants, and both will cross with all other varieties within the huge Brassica oleracea species, which includes all cabbages, except Chinese cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, collards, kohlrabi. Beginning seed savers should restrict themselves to one variety of Brassica oleracea per year. That means allowing just one variety of broccoli to flower, for example, and making sure that within a 1 mile radius, there are no flowering plants of Brussels sprouts, cabbages, cauliflowers, collards, kales, or kohlrabis. Advanced seed savers may want to try methods of alternate day caging or caging with introduced pollinators. Broccoli and cauliflower are biennials, and both must undergo vernalization in order to flower. In some regions where winter temperatures do not drop below 28 degrees Fahrenheit, brassicas can be planted in the fall, and seed is harvested the following summer. In addition, some of the shorter season broccolis, when planted in early spring, will flower and produce seed in one season. Nice. In cold winter areas, broccoli and cauliflower plants are carefully dug in the fall and stored between 32 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit and at 80 to 90% humidity. Even under the best conditions, however, the plants will quickly succumb to rot, often remaining in good condition for only 4 to 6 weeks. Broccoli cuttings can sometimes be rooted and grown in a greenhouse until planted out the next spring. Cauliflower seed production is generally limited to mild winter areas. Seed producers in Japan have developed an interesting method for broccoli seed production. The plants are sown in the spring, and the central head is harvested at least 2 months before a killing frost. The central head stump is cut to 4 to 6 inches above the ground. The resulting side shoots are cut when 4 inches tall. They're treated then with a rooting hormone and planted in heated nursery beds. These rooted shoots are planted out the following spring. Since the rooted plant cuttings have undergone vernalization already, they will bolt in the late spring and produce seed. It is interesting. When broccoli and cauliflower are grown for seed, the heads should not be harvested for food. Some gardeners cut the central head of broccoli and only let the side shoots go to seed. While this works, the seed crop is of lesser quality and quantity. The cauliflower head must be intact to produce a good seed crop. Most broccoli and cauliflower is self-incompatible. To ensure a good seed set and to preserve as much genetic diversity as possible, a minimum of 6 plants should be used for seed saving. 20 plants will provide a much greater genetic base. Broccoli and cauliflower produce seed stalks 4 feet or taller. The yellow flowers are attractive to bees. These seeds, broccoli and cauliflower, will remain viable for 5 years when stored under ideal conditions. It's about 6,000 to 9,000 seeds per ounce, depending on the variety. They're frost-tolerant plants that are best grown for seed in mild winter climates. Both may be direct seeded or greenhouse started. Cover the seeds about 1/2 inch deep, but it's common for broccoli to be direct seeded, while cauliflower is more often transplanted. The optimum seed germination temperature is 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Germination usually occurs 5 to 7 days in at least at 70 degrees. Plant or set out in full sun. And that's all that is recommended in seed to seed. So some good information in there, especially about how the varieties will interfere with each other. I don't think beginning gardeners are necessarily aware that your broccoli and your cauliflower and any number of these other phenotypes, these other morphologies within the species Brassica oleracea, are going to mess with each other. So wanted to throw that out there. For those of you that have stuck throughout the entire Crop Focus, actually for everybody, thank you so much for listening to the Ice Age Farmer podcast. I hope you got something out of this show. This has been episode 19. And please spread the word about what's going on with the climate, with our modern agriculture failing, indeed the security on our streets of Western civilization threatened. I hope you are preparing yourself and your family for what we are seeing actively around us. And I thank you for spreading the word about the broadcast. For now, this has been Christian with episode 19 of the Ice Age Farmer podcast. Let's go do great things.